I will say Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
Good to see. Good to see everybody here. It's unbelievably the 1st of June, where things are going. Greetings to everybody online. I know Bree and Alex are waiting for the kids to wake up, so we look forward to seeing you. And to those of you that are watching online, I'm hoping everything is going better now. I decided this last week, I thought, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. I pay for this internet and it should work. So I called the company and I said, all I want to do is be able to, for 2 hours a week, to be able to upload something, you know. And so the guy was really nice about it. He said, you know, and I'll come in on Saturday and I'll monitor the thing. He said, they're now going to open up the upload side of my deal from 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock every Saturday. So hopefully our recent streaming woes are over. So the new system is working good, I hope. So getting into this, we're pretty deep into our series, part 94. We're going to pick up today where we left off last time. We're in Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6, the majority of this chapter deals with what's called the Nazirite vow. Now, to begin with, I don't want anybody making the mistake that a lot of people do in Christendom, and that is that a Nazirite and a Nazarene are the same thing. They're not. It's not even close. Yeshua was called a Nazarene because his hometown was Nazareth, and that's just what they called people from Nazareth. They called them Nazarenes. And so there is no connection, no matter what people tell you, between a Nazarene and a Nazirite. Yeshua was simply a Nazarene because he was from Nazareth. What we're going to read today in Numbers 6 is the only place in Torah where you will find any reference to the Nazirite vow. There are a number of places in the rest of the Bible, in the Tanakh and in the Second Testament. That's what I like to call the Old Testament, the First Testament, and the Second Testament, because they are all that's what they are, the First and Second Testament of Yeshua. In the Tanakh, we have what will probably come to mind first would be Samuel and Samson. They're referred to as Nazirites, but as you get towards the back of the book, to the next testament of Yeshua, some will say that John the Baptist was a Nazirite. Well, that's pretty sketchy. Primarily because John the Baptist was a Levite. So if you think about being a Levite, you are already set apart. You're already set aside for service to God. So they would rarely make a vow. And you do have the example of Paul, we're going to get to this a little bit later, who did participate in a Nazirite vow when he came to Jerusalem and James had him, I'll get into more of that later, but that's in Acts 21, remember when he was called to the carpet in Jerusalem. So, like I say, we'll get to that later, but some of the commentators out there will also suggest that Yeshua was a Nazirite, but there's literally no biblical evidence for that at all. So I'm not sure where they come up with that. As far as I can see, there's a lot of reasons that he wasn't, and there really isn't any that he was. So let's just get into this with that. I want to go through these words of Yehovah and just get the whole perspective of what's going on here with this Nazirite vow. We're going to read this section together. starting in verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman consecrates an offering to take the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink." "Neither shall he drink any grape juice nor eat fresh grapes or raisins. All the days of his separation he shall not eat. He shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin. All the days of the vow of his separation, no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy, separated. Then he shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body. He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother or his brother or his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation he shall be holy to the Lord. And if anyone dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head. On the day of his cleansing, on the seventh day, he shall shave it. On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and the priest shall offer one as a sin offering and the other as a burnt offering, and to make atonement for him, because he sinned in regard to the corpse, and he shall sanctify his head that same day. He shall consecrate to the Lord the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb in its first year as a trespass offering, but the former days shall be lost. The former days will be lost because his separation was defiled. Now this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of his separation are fulfilled, when it's done, he shall be brought to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and he shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb in its first year without blemish as a burnt offering, one ewe lamb in its first year without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering. It's a lot. A basket of unleavened bread, cakes of flour mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and their grain offering with their drink offerings. It costs you something. Okay. Then the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of a peace offering to the Lord. With the basket of unleavened bread, the priest shall also offer its grain offering and its drink offering. Then the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. This is at the end. And he shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the boiled shoulder of the ram, one unleavened cake from the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and put them upon the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his consecrated hair. And the priest shall wave them as a wave offering before the Lord. They are holy for the priest, together with the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the heave offering. So those go to the priest. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. In other words, it's his vow is finished. And he says, this is the law of the Nazarite who vows to the Lord the offering for his separation. And besides that, whatever else is in his hand, he is able to provide according to the vow which he takes, so he must do according to the law of his separation. Make sense? Are we all done? That's perfectly clear, right? What's going on here? Let's unpack this a little bit. And because, you know, as I got into this study, and I wish I had longer to do it, from a historical viewpoint, there's a number of points here. So I want to go back up to the top here at the beginning. We understand that the way you become a Nazarite is by taking a vow. You take a vow. A man can take the vow and a woman can take the vow, either one. And you become a Nazarite for a period of time, for a period of time of this vow. Now, the first thing that comes to mind is, what is a Nazarite vow? Why would I want to do this? Well, the general answer, generally what would happen is someone would swear an oath to God to make some sort of a, if you want to call it a deal or a promise to Him. Like maybe if God would grant some kind of special favor to them, to cure them of a disease or restore their wealth, or if a woman's womb was closed, she might, make a deal with God to open her womb, or a man to be successful in war or for protection. You know, you could think of a zillion things, probably, of things that you might want to go to God and petition Him for. And so then for a certain period of time, they would, in this deal, if you would, they would say, I'm going to sanctify myself. I'm going to set myself apart for service wholly to you. That's what I'm going to do. So I'm going to make this vow. And this is why it's talking about consecrating and separating. That's what this is about. So the problem is that it didn't take long in the application of this for a person to get very casual about it. It began to, like, you're even sort of making a bet. You know, you in today's thing, you would say, well, I'm so sure those Chiefs are going to win the Super Bowl this year that if they don't, I'm going to take a Nazarite vow till next Super Bowl. That's kind of how it got to. This got to be so prevalent in society as it went on in Israeli society that sometimes the priests were presiding over these. We read what had to happen with all of the priest had to have this sacrifice and that thing. And well, sometimes they would group hundreds of them together and do them all at the same time for efficiency. Okay, so it got very, very fuzzy very quickly as to, you know, how this was applied when you look back in history. And really, this kind of thing is not uncommon, because the idea of a Nazarite, of what it meant to be one, what it looked like, who could be one, how long the vow, you know, the length of time, and then even what the duties and the responsibilities around that, all changed, fluctuated up and down and all over the map from these basic words that we read here in Numbers 6. This is an example of what I have said before about there being a difference in the Word of God between things that are prescriptive and descriptive. Okay? We have a lot of things that we go through in the Red Letter series and this Thus Saith the Lord series, where we're looking exactly at what God said. Those are prescriptive. And the Bible has a lot of descriptive things and commentary about what happened. And just because you read something in the Bible that it happened in the Bible, or what somebody said, or this person did that, or this, it does not mean that particular thing is God approved, that it's sanctioned by Him. In fact, it's a great deal of time the Bible is describing things that are not ordained by Him at all. So a lot of times those are lessons of things that we should not be doing. And sometimes that's clear. For example, the golden calf incident. They made that calf, and the Bible is very clear that they shouldn't have made the calf. The people that made the calf were punished and dealt with. Okay, but not all of the events are like that. Sometimes we have things that that where there is no mention of whether that was good or bad. So what we have to have is an understanding of the prescriptive things of God first, so that when we read those things, we can put them in context of whether that was right or wrong. And so we have to apply those principles that God has already given us. And furthermore, many times the Bible does not comment on whether the thing was good or bad because it makes the assumption that you already know. The Torah was put at the front of the book for a reason, folks. And so, you know, we've uncovered over the years so many things, especially in the Next Testament, that it's completely misunderstood because, well, they didn't know that you don't know how to read it, right? Because you don't have the prescriptive things in which to base your interpretation on. So we just need to know that sometimes the Bible, we have a saying, it goes without saying, right? Well, there's a lot of things in the Next Testament that goes without saying if you have already set the foundation. All right, and so in terms of the Nazirite vow from a historical context, it's like I said, things got real fuzzy real fast. What was described here, even just a few hundred years after this, or even probably sooner than that, it doesn't match up. It doesn't match up with what they were doing. For instance, how this operated in Samson's day, or Samuel's day, or even later still in Paul's day. Not the same. But we need to understand one thing very clearly. It's not because God changed his mind. It's because people, men, didn't follow it. They changed it, right? Here's an example. In the last installment of this, and I was thinking while we were singing that last song, I should have played that week, you know, because he was writing in the... Anyway, we had a message about Numbers 5, and we compared that with the story where Yeshua was presented with a woman suspected in adultery. And you know, they were doing that to try to trap Yeshua, of course. And I said it wasn't even a good trap. Why? Because they didn't even adhere to the Levitical law for adultery, and to have her stoned. There was no witnesses. And so rather than Yeshua applying the Levitical law, he rightly applied the Numbers 5 procedure, and that is what sent the Pharisees packing. What I didn't tell you is that shortly after the death of Yeshua, a very influential rabbi declared that practice in Numbers 5 was to be abolished. He said, we're just going to get rid of it, okay? Now, was that decision by that rabbi an evil one? Was he trying to go against God? Was he thinking that God was making this decision and was using him to do it? Don't know. But I do think that he thought he was doing the right thing. And the reason that he was doing the right thing is because he wasn't really abolishing Numbers 5. Because it had gotten so twisted and with all of their different rules and all these things. I mean, look, it got really perverse, right? So we know that both the man and the woman are to be stoned in adultery. Well, the men didn't get stoned, right? the women, they took this thing and they reformed it and whatever to make it so that all a man had to do if he wanted out of this marriage was say, oh, I think she's cheating on me, and then give her a certificate of divorce. So when he abolished the Numbers 5, he wasn't really abolishing Numbers 5. He was abolishing what had become Numbers 5, right? And so I rewind back to that message just to say, just as an illustration of what is going on here with the Nazirite vow, because it's a similar evolution of the practices and the customs that occurred with this idea of taking a Nazirite vow. Most of what you read in your Bible about Nazirite vow, I'm going to say this very clearly, is not prescriptive. It is descriptive. And it's not even a descriptive, it's not even an accurate description of what is to be done in most cases. And it's that fact that made this study, you know, particularly difficult. For instance, look here at verse 13. It says, this is the law of the Nazirite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. Then he's to be brought in front of the door, and we read all the rest of it. All the things that had to be done when the vow was done, when it was finished. Okay? But then you start studying into this and you find that even though this is clear that this is a certain amount of time and it has an ending to which the person is alive and at the temple or the tabernacle finishing the vow, you have all of these teaching out there that there's two Nazirite vows. One is called the perpetual vow, and the other one, oddly enough, is for life. I know, right? You first go, what are they talking about? Why in the world they would make the one that is for a certain period of time, why they would translate that to perpetual? I mean, when we hear the word perpetual, what do we think of? Well, it's ongoing, right? But that's not it. They used perpetual to talk about this, and then they would talk about the one for life, which is really odd. There's no biblical instruction, guidance, anything for a Nazirite for life. This is the only part of the Torah, the only part of the law that deals with the Nazirite. There's nothing in your Bible that talks about a Nazirite for life. Now, where'd that come from? It came from, well, probably to start with one woman, but it came from women desiring to have a son, desiring to make a deal with God and say, well, if you'll give me a son, I will give him to you, and he won't, you know, drink alcohol, he won't, you know, cut his hair, he won't do these things. They tried to apply it that way, okay? But according to what Yehovah lays out here, you can't make a vow for someone else. Whether it's a Nazirite vow or any vow, you can't make a vow for somebody else. It does not exist here. But we see it in Scripture, don't we? Descriptively. In 1 Samuel, Hannah is barren. She desperately wants Yehovah to open her womb, so she prays this. 1 Samuel 1:11. Then she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. Now it appears that it's a Nazirite vow, doesn't it? But it cannot be. Just because it is descriptive, a descriptive account of what Hannah did with Samuel, does not make it prescriptive of what God intended for the Nazirite vow, no matter how it's interpreted or even managed as if it was one. Again, there's no godly prescription for a Nazirite for life. And if there was, it would have to have been made by that person, not by the mother. Again, you can't make a vow for somebody else. Now, I'm not trying to take away from the story of Samuel. That's not what I'm trying to do. It's just to say that it's a descriptive account of this and is not in alignment with the prescriptive law of Yehovah. And this is because the practice got very flippantly applied, misapplied from the very start. Far as I can tell, the whole concept of a Nazirite vow got intermingled with all sorts of other religious beliefs within various sects of Judaism. Seems that in an effort to be especially pious, many could kind of take on the attributes of a Nazirite to seem more, I don't know, holy? Okay? You had sects of Judaism that resembled what we would think of as like monks or nuns. And even the Levites got confused because, again, they were born into set-apartness, right? There's no need for them to take a vow to do the same thing. They were born into that. But yet, a lot of them still did, oddly enough. So did this being a Nazirite make you a priest? No, not at all. A priest, as you well know, has to come from the bloodline of Aaron. Okay, and by all appearances, it seems intended that this God-ordained thing of a Nazirite was not to be applied to Levites. It actually excluded them. And I read one guy that pointed to this, where in the beginning of this, he said, "Speak to the children of Israel." And he makes the point that, and we studied this, right? What happened when, you know, God separated the Levites? They were no longer the children of Israel. There was a whole separate census for them and everything else. So he kind of maintains that, you know, this wasn't speaking to the Levites. This was speaking to the people of Israel, right? And so his idea was, well, God should have said, tell the people of Israel and the Levites and sons of Aaron, if that's what he had meant. I don't know. But again, we find that there is a lot of descriptive things about the Nazirite and only this one prescriptive one. But yet still, some of the Levites did take the vow. And you see that. Now, why would they do that? It's kind of a mystery to me. I can't answer that question. It's probably another one of those non-God-ordained changes that we discussed that occurred spontaneously. In Hebrew society, they just, you know, we know the history of those people. They weren't exactly, strict, right? Anyway, they were allowed to do it. And you might think that, you know, you had all the Levites, and then you had the lineage of Aaron, who were the priests. And so all the Levites were like grunts, for lack of a better way of putting it. So maybe they thought that if they did a Nazirite vow, it would kind of elevate them closer to what the priests were. So it sort of makes sense. Let's look at verses 3 through 6 here. I'm not going to read this again, but I just want that on the screens because we have really three attributes of a Nazirite. One, they can't have wine or any part of the grape, raisin, vine, any of it. They can't have none of it, okay? They can't cut their hair during the time of their vow, and they can't be around a dead body. What we find in essence is that the Nazirite, by means of his vow and his following these three basic requirements, they could be seen as being elevated up, more equal to the priest, but not a priest. And so what happened, as usual, over time, tradition started to play more and more of a prominent role in Judaism. The rules started piling up, rules upon rules, you know how they do, because three just wasn't good enough, right? And so as one would expect from man-made rules and doctrines, they changed over time. So various parts of the Bible, we will see some of these prohibitions lifted. Sometimes you'll see them expanded. Sometimes you'll see more than just this list. And none of that was a God thing. Again, you got to continually think prescriptive versus descriptive. As I said, two of these three attributes listed in number 6 are very similar to what was required of a priest. But if you look more closely at it, the Nazirite requirement was actually more stringent. A priest certainly can drink wine. Now, he couldn't drink wine before the day before his service in the tabernacle or temple, and he couldn't drink while he was there, but he could have wine as a beverage. Whereby the Nazirite, I mean, he can't even be around the vines, much less the wine itself. The priests could not touch a dead body, but they could be around, but they could tend to their father and their mother and their brother and sister. Nazirite can't even be around them at all. Nobody. And so you start to see that the requirements kind of got to be almost like what the high priest had to deal with. But then we see something that was exactly opposite of the priest, and that is the hair. The hair on the Nazirite was required not to be cut. You kind of see that in a minute when we get through into some definitions. It wasn't to be cut. But all of the priests, all of the Levites, none of them could have long hair. It had to be kept short. Paul later said to the church in Corinth, does that not even nature teach us that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? So what's going on here? Why did the Nazirite vow have them cutting it, not cutting it during their vow, but yet the priests were forbidden to let it grow? I think some of that gets cleared up as we look into some definitions. The word Nazirite comes from the word Nazir, and the spelling's important, N-A-Z-I-R. And it is a word that came to be used as the term for pruning the grapes. You would Nazir the grapes. And so that sort of starts to tie this Nazirite prohibition against consuming anything of the grapes or the vine, but we're not told directly why. There is an explanation that I read that does make sense. Israel, as we know, is often symbolized by the grapevine in the Bible. And the idea is that every 7 years, the sabbatical year, the land was to lay fallow. They weren't to harvest anything. It wasn't tilled, it was weeded, nothing. And the grapevines were not to be pruned. The grapes were allowed to rot on the vine, and even the twice a year pruning that was supposed to happen was not to be happened. All of that was suspended during the sabbatical year. And that's a year that is what? Set apart for God. And so the Nazarite is saying, I'm going to set apart a certain amount of time for God. A sabbatical to God, so to speak, right? So that's the theory, that he's set apart for God for a certain time. And that would correspond then to the time that God had set apart the land. And so, well, that's why they're not allowed to touch it. So that's a theory, and it kind of makes a little sense because of this word. This word Nazarite means set apart, and it also means pruned. So you can see the connection there. There's more though. Hebrew is a root word language. So what happens is they'll have a word and they'll either add a consonant or take one away or add a vowel or change a vowel within that word. And each time they do that, the word can take on a narrower or a broader meaning. So bear that in mind, because we're going to look at three versions of this root word that kind of gives us some insight. It gives us they're quite interesting when we look at this study. The base word Nazir, as I said, literally means set apart or pruned. So if you literally translate the statement, they're not really a Nazarite, as we would say, because we say, well, that they're a Nazarite. Now, what we would say is they're set apart. This person is pruned, or this person is set apart. You see what I mean? They're pruned away or set apart from everybody else. That's Nazir, N-A-Z-I-R. And it's a positive term that indicates being specially, it's an elevation, it's a positive thing of being separated for God. Okay, but the Nazarites must also Nazer, N-A-Z-A-R. And that is how they would say that they are separated from the grapes. Separated in the negative sense that they can't have it anymore, that it's a prohibition. Then there's the Hebrew word Nazir, N-E-Z-E-R, which literally means shoot or branch. And that is the term for an unpruned grapevine. Okay? So if you got to keep all the... there's a lot to try to link together here. What is interesting about that is that it's the term that is used to describe the high priest's hat. Remember when we went through that, the one with the golden band, okay? It's the same word, the same term used to describe that hat and the long hair of the Nazarite. So in reading these passages in Hebrew, there's this obvious parallel between the high priest's hat, his head covering, and the Nazarite's long hair, his head covering, or hers. You know, this is him or her. So this Nazir with an I, Nazir with an E, Nazir with an A, it all works together to help understand the relationship now between the priests, the grapevine being set apart for God, and as well as the head coverings. So in terms of the head coverings, the Nazarite hair, there's something interesting that is exposed by the fact that the other thing that separated the Nazarite was this strict command not to be around the dead, which is elevated above the priests. If they did, they became ritually unclean. And at that point, they had to go through this seven-day period of purification that we read, and they had to shave their head. Now, if they had to go through that, because they failed some way in their vow. Let's say you made a vow for 6 months, six new moons, right? And you got 5.5 months in and you messed up and you got near a dead body or you whatever, okay? You had to go through the 7-day thing, and then when I read it, I kind of emphasized it. None of those days count. You got to go all the way back and you got to start your six new moons over again. I think I put this up there. Yeah, I did. So it says that, but the former day shall be lost because his separation was defiled. And this is where where it kind of starts to tie together, because this is Nazir with an E. Now remember, it's the Nazir with an E that is used to describe the head covering in the long hair of the Nazirite and the high priest, right? So it's saying here that his head covering was defiled. His head covering was defiled. This is because the sign of a Nazirite was the hair. Just like the sign of the high priest, one of the signs of the high priest was his special head covering, his hat. And to understand this, you have to look at Middle Eastern cultures of the day. To the pagan nations, which had, you know, they had all that influence on the Hebrews. It's interesting. The liver and the kidneys are thought to be the same way we think of the heart and the brain. So, in other words, love for them was not of the heart. It was of the kidneys. Love came from the kidneys. The thought processes did not take place in the brain. They took place in the heart. The heart was where the thought was. And the liver had everything to do with like where emotions sprang from. Jealousy and envy and anger, rage, that came from the liver. And so in all of that, then there's the hair. You read about the hair. Well, the hair was the part of the human anatomy that was seen as very important to them. It was considered to be the seat of a person's vitality. Sound familiar with Samson? That's where it came from. Okay, once again, description, prescription. Because hair in the pagan world was often used as a burnt sacrifice. They would shave their head and they would sacrifice that to the gods and goddesses. Therefore, as the hair was thought to be the seed of life, then it was the hair that then carried the defilement. And so it was the hair then at the end of the seventh day, purification, that was then shaved off, okay, and thrown away. In contrast to at the end of a successful vow, the hair was shaved off, but then offered on the altar as a sacrifice. So, in the same way that the hair carried the purity of a person's life force, that's why they would shave it off at the end of the vow, and it would be something that would be pure and holy and could be then offered to God. But the hair of a defiled Nazirite was not offered to God. In fact, history says that many times they would either bury it in the ground or they would burn it up in a common fire. All right. So after shaving his hair off, the ritual, the whole vow period is ended. And so we have these words, after the Nazirite may drink wine again. So he's saying it's kind of over. This is the point in which he's released from the vow. Now I will say this. There's a lot more I learned about the hair, but I didn't want to go off on a tangent and talk about hair for 30 minutes. But there was a lot of interesting things that came out about the hair. But I wanted time to focus on a couple more things. I want to go to Acts chapter 21, okay? And we're going to see Paul there with four other men who have some way or another violated their Nazarite vow. Starting in verse 17, it says, "And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. When he had greeted them, he told them in detail these things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord, and they said to him, 'You see, brother, how many myriads of Jews there are who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law.'" Kids, you really need to stop talking, please. Please. Verse 21, "But they have been informed about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children nor walk according to the customs. What then? The assembly must certainly meet, for they will hear that you have come. Therefore, do what we tell you, for we have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them and pay their expenses." It was expensive. Remember all those things that they had to do. "So that they may shave their heads, and that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law. But concerning the Gentiles who believe, we have written and decided that they should observe no such thing, except that they should keep themselves from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality." And so Paul took them in, and the next day, having been purified with them, so he went through it, entered the temple to announce the expiration of the days of purification, at which time an offering should be made for each one of them. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, the law, and this place. And furthermore, he also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled the holy place." Now, we've discussed this before, but what I want to bring out here this time is it's obviously about four Nazarites. And as equally as apparent to anyone who's read Torah, they're dealing with the 7 day time of purification. Okay, they've been defiled within their Nazarite vow. And so we know that because of the 7 day period of purification. We're told that Paul also had his head shaved and went through the purification process right along with these men. Now that can only mean one thing, okay? That Paul had taken the vow of a Nazarite. It was never contemplated or even permitted that someone could join other people out of being sorry for them or sympathy or some act of unity that you would go with them to do their purification. So Paul had to have been in the midst of a Nazarite vow at this time. Now, we are not told why Paul needed to engage in the purification, but it did work out to be beneficial. I mean, Paul was going to be walking around now in Jerusalem with a bald head, and everybody there would have known what that bald head meant, that he was still walking according to the law of Moshe, and then this would obviously help squelch the rumors to the contrary. Now, this was not the only time, the only indication that we have that Paul entered into Nazarite vows. Because you see, it's you know, you can have a Nazarite vow for a time, and then you're done with it. It might be a year later, you might do it again, right? Okay, so in Acts 18, we read this. "So Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. Now, obviously, we don't have a lot of information here, but one thing we can tell is the ritual had undergone a lot of fluctuations and changes by this point. For instance, in Numbers 6, the vow was supposed to end at the temple, right? And the hair was supposed to be offered as a sacrifice and burned. Well, he had his hair cut off, not in Jerusalem. So now maybe he had it trimmed a little bit and then planned to cut it the rest of the way over there. Don't know. Maybe, perhaps, rabbinic law had changed to the point where that kind of thing was allowed because they were dispersed a lot out of Jerusalem. So maybe they allowed that the vow to end not at the temple. Maybe they could have been able to save the hair and then later come to the temple and in the vow. And then I thought, well, maybe this is why he went to Jerusalem and had to do the purification, because he had already shaved his head when he wasn't at the temple. I don't know. There's not a lot of information here. But it speaks to the fact that, you know, Paul was making vows, and apparently Nazirite vows, because of the shaving of his head. We can't know for sure. There are some things that we can clear up about the Nazirite vow. Nazirites were not some kind of weird hermit that went off and ate locusts and honey like John the Baptist. Okay? If John had been a Nazirite, the locusts and honey he ate, the clothes he wore, the solitary lifestyle that he led would have had nothing to do with a Nazirite vow. Nazirites had no special food except for they could not do the grape stuff, right? They still had to eat kosher. They wore normal clothes. They got married. They all these things. So they held jobs, all these things. So do know that nowhere in your Bible does it say that John the Baptist was a Nazirite. It doesn't say it. It's merely an assumption, again, based on his mother. But what did she say? She vowed not to drink wine while John was, you know, in her womb, and that she would insist that he would never drink wine. But again, mom can't make a Nazirite vow for the child. So another reason was that John the Baptist was already a Levite. So again, back to that, there's no reason for him to have taken the vow. It was already in service to the Lord. It would have just been duplicating it. I've stressed throughout this that the application of number 6 and the Nazirite vow underwent many modifications by the religious leaders. Parts of a kind of a modified Nazirite vow were employed in different eras, in different times, in different ways, but it's not consistent with what we read here. You can get into this, and you can read all sorts of different rulings and stuff in the Mishnah and the Talmud about how the rabbis interpreted this and a bunch of different ways. They put a lot more restrictions on it sometimes. Other times it was even less than what was here. And so the point is, you can't associate, well, let me say it this way. Even Samson, okay, who is clearly defined as a Nazirite in your Bible, he's referred to that way, as a Nazirite for life. Well, guess what? That designation didn't even exist. It doesn't exist. He didn't seem to pay it much attention to the Nazirite restrictions of number 6, other than his hair. And that idea of the strength and life force coming from the hair did not come from this. It came from paganism. Okay. And Samson, you know, he certainly did everything possible not to serve God until later in his life, right? So we've got to be very careful in assigning various biblical characters that came centuries after what God put here, and giving them the title of a Nazarite in the sense of what is spoken in number 6. Abstaining from wine or strong drink does not mean, it's not a sure sign of a Nazarite. Neither is long hair service, you know, saying he's a Nazarite. I wanted to highlight this as a way of kind of trying to pull this together, because I thought, okay, what does all this mean? What do we take from this? And then I read it again, and this word just stood out to me. It seems to me that this may be the best way of looking at this. That is possibly the best way of seeing it as God sees it. Taking a Nazarite vow. Is an offering. It's an offering to God. It's not of animals. It's not of grain or wine or oil or anything like that. It's an offering of one's self. Separating oneself to serve God, not because you were born a Levite, not because you were a descendant of Aaron, not because your mama said so, but because you want to separate your life and take your time and give it to God. See, you can offer all sorts of things to God, but the most valuable thing that you have is your time, where you stop tending to your own needs and you dedicate a period of time to completely focusing on God and His desires. And I'm going to tell you, you don't find very much of that in the Bible with respect to the supposed examples of the Nazarite vow. I will say though, but for Paul, I mean, certainly he did dedicate himself to God, didn't he? Now, more times than others. Paul had to work. He worked for a living. So there might have been times where he finished a vow and then he went to work. And then he says, oh, I'm going to make this missionary trip over here and I'm going to make a vow to God to go do this and go do it. You know, I do think that Paul really understood the essence of that vow. We don't have a lot of information about it, but we do know a lot about Paul and about his life and about how he did things. Okay? I don't know. But I would sure hope that Paul understood the right application of this. Certainly there were many that didn't. Okay. Well, we're going to try to finish the chapter. I'll do that real quick. The chapter closes with this famous Aaronic blessing. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And so they shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. This is the blessing for the children of Israel. This is the blessing for Israel, not for the world. This is the blessing for us, the grafted in children of Israel. Okay? And this blessing was spoken. The priest would speak this blessing every day right after the morning sacrifices. Because one of the primary duties of the priesthood was to bless Israel. As a side note, I think that's maybe one reason why Moshe didn't make it into the Promised Land. Because he didn't bless. Remember when he got up there and he cursed Israel out. Yeah, he's not supposed to do that. He's supposed to bless them. But anyway, that's a side note. Blessing here in our language and in Christianity is a broad and inclusive term, but that's really only because of our ignorance. Blessing, biblically speaking, blessing is very specific in its meaning. Blessing is God bestowing upon His people the things that God believes are important and good for us. As you look across the Bible at the things of the blessings, you see good health and land and safety and sufficient food, children. Guys, blessing is a verb. It involves action. God feeling kindly towards us. That's nice, but that's not blessing us. We want His favor for sure, but that's not what blessing means. It's like how I talk about the word love. Love is not a feeling. Love is an action. It's a verb. It's only in our modern, you know, Western culture that love has become like an emotion and a fuzzy, romantic feeling. Love has an emotional component, yes, but just as James said that faith without action is no faith at all, love without action is no love at all. So would you want God to just feel all warm and fuzzy about you but not give you the tangible things that you need? Of course you wouldn't. So it's good to see that this is a blessing. It's a blessing that is promising God's act, the verb act of blessing, of giving to us the things that we need. Okay? Protection, grace, peace. In the Hebrew, it is those things: protection and grace and shalom. And I say Shabbat shalom every week. Sabbath peace. But look, shalom means a lot more than even just peace. It means well-being in every sense. It means that God is near to you. It means that He loves you. It means that salvation is there. It means that He is sufficient for everything that you need, and that there is a lack of fear. Okay? Shalom. You read here this word Lord. But in every case, this is just, not just, it is Yehovah. It's Yehovah. May Yehovah bless and keep you. Yehovah make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yehovah lift up His countenance upon you and give you shalom. Amen.